the part of the Old Testament that are called the prophets. If you were here yesterday, I tried to begin by suggesting that we not only interact with five of the prophetic documents, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Jonah, but that also that we try, as we glean insights from these writings, to build a composite model of what the prophetic task really is. Because the gift of prophecy, that is, the function of prophecy, is absolutely essential in the life of God's people. And many of you stress this. So building a model of what it means to be prophet, as well as looking at the way several different men did the task. I suggested yesterday that as a kind of foundational baseline, that the prophet's task is twofold as I see it. First, it's the task of understanding, of trying to see deeply and clearly into the shape of reality. Now, this understanding, I think, comes from several different sources. It comes from profoundly interacting with God and what He is saying about life. It comes by listening to what's going on inside of the prophet himself, his experience. It comes from living very deeply into the times, what's happening historically, the interaction of social forces. And it's out of the convergence of all of these forces that the prophetic insight is born. And the aim of it is to help people see things profoundly as they are. The other task is that this word of insight be a part of the healing process. The prophet often sounds negative, but I was suggesting that the true prophet hurts in order to heal. He is not interested just in venting hostility, in saying, I don't like something because it's imperfect. He's really engaged in the process of helping a sick situation get better. The prophetic word ought to be a word of insight. The prophetic word ought to be a word of healing. So, with that little background momentum, let's move today to the prophet Hosea. And let's try to interact with him. Let me say that the book of Hosea is one of the most difficult and complicated of all the scripture to read. The first time I heard a sermon on Hosea, I was entranced. When I went and read the book, I was completely confused. Because the book is a compilation of very emotional words that were born out of a great personal crisis, both in the prophet's life and in the life of the nation. And it doesn't have much coherence. It is not a narrative. If you sit down and read it, you really have to piece together what is the situation that gives rise to these utterances. So I want to warn you in advance that as you read the book of Hosea, you're going to have to realize that here was a man under great emotional stress. Much of this doesn't seem to follow a coherent pattern. But perhaps if we can sketch in the background of the times and the man, then as you read these different utterances of his, you'll begin to see how this prophetic word was born and some of its deeper insights. Yesterday, we noticed that the man Amos, the way he lived his life, had a great effect on what he saw and how he approached the problem of Israel. Okay, Hosea lived in the same time that Amos did. Now, he lived in the northern kingdom to which Amos went and said his prophetic word. Hosea was involved himself in what happened to the country of Israel in the last half of the 8th century B.C. The things that Amos began to prophesy were slowly coming true right before Hosea's eyes. This society, which Amos saw, had no future to it because it was organized on such an unjust, inhumane basis. This society began to topple right before Hosea's eyes. A strong king, Jeroboam, died in 747. A group of weak rulers came along that were not able to hold the fabric of the nation together. They got more and more polarized between the rich and the poor. And so finally, when the Assyrians came in 721, the rich were not strong enough to fight. The poor had no reason to fight. And the nation just collapsed like a house of cards, and many of them were taken into exile. Okay, Hosea lived through this experience, not as an outsider, but as one who was a participant. And he saw the problem that Israel was undergoing, her faults and all of this, from an entirely different perspective than Amos did. Amos was very objective. Amos could come in much like a doctor, diagnose the problem, and then it was yours to work with, and walked out and left. But Hosea was much more intimately involved with the sickness, with the tragedy. His stance was not over against as much as being immersed in what was taking place. However, it was not just the national crisis that was a problem for Hosea. He had a personal crisis, a great trauma within his own individual life and marriage that was to be the matrix out of which his insight into what was wrong with Israel and what Israel could hope for was born. You are perhaps familiar with the broad outlines of Hosea's life. He married a woman named Gomer. And it appears from the best we can put together that at the time of their marriage, she was a healthy, chaste person. And that at the beginning their marriage was very joyful, as it should be. And everything went well through the birth of their first child, who was a little lad named Jezreel. However, between the birth of their first child and their second child, just a faint shadow of suspicion begins to come on the horizon. You get the first inkling that everything is not right in the marriage and in the home, because the second child was a girl, and as was the Hebrew custom, Hosea named this child prophetically. He named her "She that never knew a father's love," Lo Ruhama, it is in the Hebrew. And here is the hint that perhaps this child was not fathered by the one that was the husband of her mother. By the time the third child was born, the situation was clearly out in the open. This was a boy, and Hosea named this child, "Not no kin of mine, not my people." Lo Anami is the name in Hebrew. By this time, it's clear this child was illegitimate. This child was not Hosea's child. It became obvious that Gomer for some time had been engaging in several extramarital relationships. And shortly after the third child was born and the issue was out in the clear, Gomer just splits the scene altogether, tells Hosea that she wants to have nothing to do with what they had built together. She walks out on him, these three children, and goes after her lovers, as she calls them, who will give her things that she wanted more. So, here is the personal tragedy out of which Hosea begins to struggle. He has been rejected as a man. He has been betrayed as a husband. He's been humiliated in the eyes of the community. He's left with the care of three children, two of whom are not his own. And here he is really up against life badly betrayed, life shattered in its primary relationships. Now, it's out of this experience that the prophetic insight of Hosea was eventually born. Amos had been a shepherd, living in loneliness, close to the ancient tradition, had developed a sharp eye so that he could see the culture. His lifestyle affected the way he interacted with Israel. Hosea was in the middle of something that both personally and nationally was absolutely tearing him asunder, because his primary relationships were being severed and broken and betrayed. Okay, out of this is why the book is so incoherent. This is why it has so little sense of pattern and narrative to it, where an outburst will go in this direction and an outburst in that. When you're reading it, realize you're reading the musings of a broken-hearted, sometime almost insanely grieving man. What did Hosea then come to sense? What word of understanding, what word of healing began to come to birth in him out of this agony? I'd like to just pick three things. There are many other points that are in the book, but I'd like to focus in on three things that seem to me come out of this experience that have export value as far as our existence is concerned. The first thing that happened was a deeper understanding of God's relationship to Israel and also to all humanity. When Hosea began to take his agony into the presence of the great sympathy, when he really began to pour out the anguish of what had happened to him, to his refuge and strength, he came to a startling realization, and that was that God already understood the dynamics of his grief, because the same thing that had happened to him had also happened to God. What began to emerge in Hosea's realization was that the analogy of lover romance, husband and wife, was really a valid way of understanding God's relationship to Israel and what Israel had done to God. He was startled to find out that he didn't have to tell God what he was feeling, because God said, "I already know what you're going through with, because I've walked that road myself." It's a very interesting way of looking at God's relationship to Israel, and beyond that, to God's relationship to all humanity. You see, there was the mystery of how God and Israel ever fell in love. You can't explain things like this. Lovers know that they are in love, but why the one picked the other, why that mystery of intensity came to life, no one can say. And there's no way to explain why Yahweh, Jehovah, had picked a slave people, the Hebrews, enslaved down in Egypt, why he had picked them to be his special people rather than the Greeks, or rather than the Phoenicians, or rather than the Egyptians, why he had picked the slave people to be his beloved and special folk, there is no way of saying. But Hosea realized that this is what God had done. He had set his affection upon this people. He had brought them out of their slavery and wooed them in the desert. There at Sinai, he had married this waif bride, had made a covenant with them, and then he had taken her into a new home, which he had promised. All you see, the analogies of a romance. But then when they had gotten to Israel, to the place, to Palestine, to the home that Yahweh had promised, then Israel began to find other divinities or other ultimate realities more attractive than her relationship to Yahweh. And so she began to be unfaithful to the relationship to God in the way that Gomer had been unfaithful to Hosea. Now, to think of God in romantic terms, to say that the way that God feels about Israel and therefore about man, the way a lover feels about a beloved, was really a very revolutionary insight. It went beyond where most people had understood the nature of divinity. And I would suggest to you this morning that this is a valid way of understanding the divine-human relationship. To believe that God has a passionate affection, that God wants to enter the kind of intimacy, the kind of oneness of life that we know humanly as a husband and a wife, to think that this is what God really wants in his relationship to each one of us, this changes religion from just being something that you fear or an obligation that you have to discharge, and it moves it into the realm of delight, of romance, of ecstasy, and one begins to see his relationship to God not as something he ought to do, but as a great gift of love and affection that one does not deserve. But just like falling in love humanly, you come into an intimacy and a joy that you had never known before. And all of it's a gift. No lover ever believes that he has earned the love that he is being given. To begin to sense religion in these categories, I think, is to really move it to the living plane. And I think it's true to the basic image of God that we find in the Scripture. When you ask the question, why did God create us anyway? You know, what was the reason back of everything being called out of nothing into existence? The Genesis stories give us the impression that God's reason for creation was simply joy. He found the fact of aliveness so wonderful that he said, "I want to share this on a wider scale. I don't want to keep aliveness to myself. I want creatures enough like myself so that they too can know the joy to share it with me." The same dynamics that causes a person to say, "I would like to marry. I would like to get out of myself. I would like to share with another. I would like for my joy to be made available to another and to be able to interact on a profound level." The same dynamics seem to be back of why God ever created anything. His only reason for creating was not to acquire something, but to give something. He wanted to let us in on the joy of aliveness. Now, if this is the primal divine image, then religion, in its profoundest sense, is a love affair. And God is the passionate, emotional, community-desiring lover, seeking man, giving the gifts of affection. And what he wants back from us is not just respect, not just fear, not even obedience. What did Jesus say? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and mind and soul and strength. And how can we love him? Because he has first loved us. He gives us the gift of life because he wants us to know his joy. Now, if we can ever get this inside of us, this kind of divine-human analogy, maybe it will lift religion out of this burdensome, onerous load that we carry around. And we begin to ask ourselves, how can I respond to the divine love? How can I enter into intimacy? How can we begin to share life in the way that lovers share life? How can we know the joy of oneness? This is what religion is all about. God, according to Hosea's insight, is lover. And I think that that's an insight that will stand up. And I would suggest that as we try to structure our own relationships to God, that this would be the productive way for us to think of it. Therefore, he first came to the realization and he told Israel, do you realize who God is? God is really our husband, lover. He brought us out of nothing into being, out of slavery into this home, all because he simply wanted to let us in on his joy. Okay, the second insight that was born of Hosea's tragedy has to do with the nature of sin. Having discovered or having come to the realization that God is really lover, taking the initiative to enter joyfully in relationship with man, why did Gomer do what she did? Why had Israel become unfaithful? What are the dynamics of evil, of sin? Why do those who are called to a life of ecstasy instead handle the gift the way that Israel and Gomer had done? Well, here I think Hosea finally comes to a very profound insight into the dynamics of sin. He came to the conclusion that Gomer had done what she did, Israel had done what they had done, because of a profound ignorance. Gomer did not know what was good for her. Israel did not realize where her true fulfillment lay. And therefore, in the fourth chapter of Hosea, in the sixth verse, you have this very pregnant phrase, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. I'm not sure that we always understand the dynamics of sin in terms of being a profound unawareness of the true realities of life. But I would say that this is the basic problem. All of us want to experience joy. Unless you're badly sick emotionally or mentally, unless you're really masochistic, ask any person and he'll say right back to you, I want to know joy, I'd like to experience fulfillment, I want to be happy. We are together in the end for which we are trying to live. Our problem is that we don't know how to get to that goal. We want to know joy, but in putting life together, we don't know how to make the realities fit so that joy grows. The problem of life is in the means. How do we get to the joy that we really want to experience? Now, I am confident that Gomer, in every one of her decisions, thought on the conscious level that she was doing that which would bring her the goal of joy. When she married Hosea, she must have thought that that held the promise for joy. But then she got into the experience and she decided, no, there is not joy in this kind of life. There is more joy in turning my back on these children, on this man, and starting out in relationships with other people. And so, again, trying to get joy, she moved in another direction. But the problem was her methodology, her way of doing life, did not have in it the realism that could get her to the goal. because she gave herself to one lover, and pretty soon he did to her what she had done to Hosea. He got tired of her. Then she began to try to find someone else, and he took all that he wanted and then discarded her. And life became more and more difficult. The thrills were harder and harder to come by. The relationships were more and more cynical, until at last, having set out to try to experience joy, she had become a degraded body. She had become a person that nobody wanted. The only thing left for her was to sell herself into slavery. Just like the prodigal son, she started out to do one thing, but she didn't know how to put it together. Her problem was methodology, and this is the problem of sin. It's not that our goal is that we want to be evil. It's that we don't know how to put life together. It's the same insight that Jesus gave in his prayer on the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I heard Martin Luther King once preach a magnificent sermon on that text. And he said that the agony of Calvary was not just human badness, it was also human blindness. These people simply didn't understand how to put life together in order to get to the goal of joy. Jesus said about Jerusalem, they didn't know the things that made for peace. But the point I'm trying to make is that sin in its profoundest sense is not knowing what really is our own good. Harry Emerson Fosdick once began a very famous sermon by alluding to a little news item in the New York Times. It told about a man who had gone down to the bus station a few days before, had bought a ticket for Detroit, paid his money, got on the bus, and rode for 12 hours. But when he got off, lo and behold, he was not in Detroit at all. He was in Kansas City, 600 miles south of where he had wanted to be. Fosdick said there was nothing wrong with his intentionality. He had his aim clearly set. There was nothing wrong with the energy that he put into the project. He did what you're supposed to do. Problem was, he'd gotten on the wrong bus. He didn't utilize a means that was able to get him to the goal where he wanted to be. Okay, now this is the sin problem as Hosea understands it. We want to know joy, but we don't know how to put life together so that joy really comes. And Israel, thinking that there was more good in other gods than in Yahweh, had followed after them, and as Amos pointed out yesterday, they had lost their sense of brotherliness, they had no real sense of relationship to God, and therefore their society was falling apart. And they didn't mean for it to be that way. We don't set out to be miserable. We don't set out to destroy ourselves, but we don't know the things that make for our peace. We don't know how to put life together so that it yields the goal that every one of us wants. So, sin then becomes a knowledge problem. It becomes finding out those realities that fit together in such a way that life really can reach its appointed goal. And of course, the whole point of the biblical story is that God not only wants us to know joy, but he knows how to put it all together. Now that's what creation is all about. The Genesis picture stories tell us that when God conceived this vision of sharing joy, he put together a world that functioned in a way that joy was really happening. When he got through it, he said, look, it is good, it is very good. Joy is possible the way life is put together. And he invited man to the party. He showed him the world, how it worked. He said, here, this is my gift to you. Share this with me. It will produce joy if you'll let it work the way I've set it up. And it was at this point, this primal point, that the real spiritual crossroads of humanity came. You know the story. The beautiful, insightful picture image, man invited to the party of creation, in all of this wonder, saying that he could eat of everything, could participate, there comes into this scene a serpent, the epitome of suspicion. The writer has him saying to man, excuse me, did I understand that God won't let you eat of any of the trees here in the garden? And man, in innocence, not realizing what was about to happen, said, oh no. Said, he'll let us eat of all of the trees The centerpiece there, the thing in the middle, he has said to us, is poisonous for humans. That if we eat that, it wasn't made for food, and it won't agree with our systems, and that if we do that, we'll be sick, we'll die. But everything else is ours for food. He has given us the whole thing. We didn't deserve it. It's all here just as a gift. And as man in his innocence was celebrating what God had given, the serpent gets a scowl and says, the old scoundrel, he's done it again. Don't you realize what is happening, man? God is putting you down. Don't you know that that centerpiece, the fruit of that tree, that's where the delight and the power is. If you will eat of that fruit, then you won't need God anymore, and he knows that. You won't have to listen to all his do's and don'ts. You won't have to act like children or slaves. You can have the run of the whole place. You can be your own God. You can put it together in your own way. If you listen to God, you're going to miss the joy. If you'll take that fruit away from him, you can be your own God, and you can create your own joy. Okay, in the words of Senator Baker, the issue was joined. And what was the issue? The issue was, where is joy? How do we get to fulfillment? The issue was the nature of the mystery that calls us into being. Is he good? Is he giving us a gift? Or is he a tyrant that we have to defend ourselves against? The ultimate issue is, how do we get to the joy that deep down our very natures cry for? Well, now, if you've read the picture story, you know that our forebears took the wrong road. They sided with suspicion. They decided to become paranoid and think that all of the universe was against them, and that they had to try to eke out their joy against the principalities and powers, instead of saying, God knows how to put it together and I will trust him. They said, my joy is not with him, it's against him. And so they believed the snake, they doubted the Creator, and we've been sick at our stomachs ever since. Humanity took the wrong road. We want joy, but here is the root of the ignorance that Hosea was talking about. We thought that we could put life together better than God had put it together, and we have found ever since then that we were wrong and that he was right. That when we try to take life, when we try to create our own joy, inevitably things don't turn out the way we hoped they would. And this is the deep spiritual problem. It's an issue of trust. It's an issue of suspicion. It's whether or not the universe that surrounds us and gives us our life is for us or against us. If you think the universe is against you, and you have to hack out your own joy, and you can't trust the way that God is putting things together, then you take the road that Gomer took, the road that Israel took, the way the prodigal son took, the way I've taken, the way you've taken. And if you live with it long enough, you come to the agony of realization that we don't know the things that make for peace. Now, why did they listen to the serpent? Man, I don't know. It was a monumental miscalculation. It would be just like me being very sick, and going to a doctor who knew what he was doing. And he would say, okay, you have this thing, and take this medicine. And I go home, and I put the medicine by my bed, and I'm lying there waiting for this cure to take hold. And the plumber comes in to fix the toilet in the room, a man who has no skill whatsoever in medicine. And he looks on the table, and he said, what is that? And I say, it's the medicine I'm taking. He said, man, these doctors, they really put it on you. You know, they're trying to make you sick, so you have to go back and make more calls. All of their medicine is just a hoax. Let me tell you what to do. Take these pills that he pulls out of his plumber's case. Take these, and they'll make you well. What kind of stupidity is it that listens to a plumber instead of a physician when he's talking about medicine? What kind of stupidity was it to listen to a snake instead of the Creator? But they did it. We do it, and this is the problem. necessity is it that listens to a plumber instead of a physician when he's talking about medicine? What kind of stupidity was it to listen to a snake instead of the Creator? But they did it, we do it, and this is the problem. Okay, if trust and suspicion is the real issue, then it seems like to me, to go on with this just a minute, that the real thing that has to happen if there's going to be healing and if there is going to be the realization of joy is that we've got to master our paranoia about God. We have got to live into our suspicions that the universe is against us. And we have got to reestablish a sense of trust that God does know how to put it together, that in His will is our shalom, our wholeness, our peace, that He really can be trusted, that the God who put it together once and it was good can put it together again if we'll let Him. Now, every one of the biblical commandments that are central are aimed at the practical goal of getting us to joy. None of God's rules are put on us just to make us know that we're subservient. They're not arbitrary negativism. God knows how to make life work. He's the one that put it together. And if we could ever get to that trust level, then we could hear His words as ways to joy, and we could overcome this insane sense that we have got to rebel against Him. For example, there's a well-known prohibition in the Old Testament that the Hebrews are not to eat pork. Is that just God being a Puritan, God just saying, I choose to make you go without that just so you'll remember that I'm the big boss and that I have the right to make you do what I want you to do? No. There is a solid reality base to that particular prohibition. Even to this day in the Middle East, if pork is not refrigerated, it spoils almost immediately. Kill a pig, don't put it in any kind of refrigeration, and in a matter of minutes, it becomes poisonous. And if you eat it, you get sick. Therefore, the word, don't eat pork, was a highly situational word aimed at the functional joy of the people that God cared about. Or circumcision, you know, the great symbol of the people of God. At that time, in that place, one of the greatest ravages of little male babies was disease that set in on that part of their body where there had not been circumcision. Circumcision was a medicinal principle. We do it today almost universally where our Western medicine is practiced. Therefore, it was not God just saying, I'm going to make you do it so I can put something on you. It was God saying, look, I want you to know joy, and I know how to put it together. Now, if we could ever come to trust the God who tells us, do this and don't do that, if we could ever get over the feeling, why is He saying it? Is He trying to put me down? And realize that He is really trying to help you get on the right bus to get to your Detroit. If we could ever get to that sense of healed trust, then the things that He commands, we see, are the way to our joy. In His will is our shalom, is our peace. And I think that if you go deeply, every one of the basic biblical structures are aimed at human fulfillment. For example, the well-known stricture about adultery, about the monogamous way of doing life as far as our relationships to peoples of other sex. This is profoundly rooted in the realities of our being. It is not an arbitrary stricture. I have so much psychic, physical, emotional energy. I can invest that energy in one master relationship and therefore know a depth, an ecstasy, an intimacy. I can get delivered out of loneliness into a profound kind of communal sharing. If I'll invest my limited pool of energy in working on one master relationship, I can know something that is profound. If I take that same energy and I piddle it out in about six or seven different directions, I in no way have the capacity to enter profoundly, intimately with many, many people. And so I wind up superficial. I wind up never getting out of my aloneness and into the depths of any other person. And when I try to have more than one, I wind up with less. This is exactly what some dear friends of mine came to the conclusion after living for 3 years in a communal relationship where they tried to be married four people in intimacy, sexual, and every other way, and they found out that finitude is the basis of monogamy. Not that God is arbitrarily saying you can't have but one, but rather saying you are only capable of so much deep relationship, and if you're going to scatter it out over every horizon, you're not going to have depth anywhere. They said after this came to a rather tragic personal end for all of them, when you try to have more, you wind up with less. Now, those were eager, searching young people who thought by this kind of action that they were really going to get to joy. But see, the problem was they got on the wrong bus. What they thought would lead to joy did not deliver them to that destination. So the point that I'm laboring and the point that finally comes through in Hosea is that the real sin issue is an ignorance. We don't know where our true good lies. We all want to be joyful, but we don't know how to put it together so we can get there. And what I'm trying to say is that there is, in trustful relationship to the ultimate, not only the desire that we have joy, but the methodology that is appropriate to our reality. And there is a deep sense in which we will never get over the sin problem till we get over the paranoid problem, that we will never really come to joy until we get back together with Him who knows how to put it together and who really wants us to have joy more than we want it ourselves. So the second insight that comes is that my people perish for lack of knowledge. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They don't know the things that make for their peace. That's my dilemma, that's your dilemma, and there is a saving word in the wisdom of God. Third thing that came to Hosea as he wrestled through this problem was that even though Gomer had really done him in, had really betrayed him and humiliated him, somehow he could not get her off his mind. He could not write her off as if she no longer had any worth. He could never quite sever the bond that he had established with this person. And as he lived into the mystery of God, and as he observed that Israel had been unfaithful but was still in existence, in other words, was still getting the gift of life, it began to dawn on him that this sense of residual relationship that he still felt for Gomer, the relationship that Israel still enjoyed with God, was a symbol of an everlasting mercy that does not give up in the face of imperfection. He began to realize that whereas sin breaks hearts, it does not break relationship. That whereas betrayal can bring all kinds of hurt and agony into a relationship, at least when you're talking about the kind of gift commitment that God has made to humanity, it does not sever the desire to help. Beyond doubt, the most beautiful and plaintive passage in all of Hosea is in the 11th chapter, the 8th and 9th verses, and if you will, I get you to turn to that. Hosea 11, 8, and 9. This is a kind of soliloquy that Hosea overheard that the mystery himself was having with himself. This is the way God agonizingly faced up to what Israel's betrayal had made him feel. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zebamin? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim. For I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst. I will not come to destroy. Here is everlasting mercy. Here is the incredible grace who gave us our lives in the beginning without our deserving, and then in the midst of betrayal is willing to give us our lives again on the same terms. When you're talking about the gift of life, you're talking about grace. None of us did anything to cause our lives to be created. That we ever came to be is sheer mercy, a gift that we did not earn, a gift that we cannot deserve, a gift that is simply given. And forgiveness is simply the re-giving of the gift of life on the same terms that it was given before, beyond our deserving. Mercy is the willingness to keep on working toward joy, even where there has been betrayal and denial. Now, I would suggest that for the person really to be a prophet in the healing sense, he has got to have touch with functional mercy. If imperfection so infuriates you that you only want to punish and destroy, if weakness and sin are so repulsive that you just can't stand it, then you can destroy, but you cannot be an instrument of healing. Only the person who takes sickness and evil seriously, but not ultimately. Only the person who is willing to see hope on the other side of the wreckage is a person that is participating in functional mercy, who is willing to pick up the pieces and keep on keeping on and not let sin become the final word. Now, this is what Hosea sensed was God's attitude toward Israel. He was brokenhearted, but he did not sever the relationship. He was greatly, greatly agonized, but he did not sever, did not say, "It's over, I give up, I quit." Now, the beautiful thing is that Hosea, sensing of the everlasting mercy, the functional hope that was at work in Yahweh's relationship to Israel, decided to act on his own residual feelings. And so in the story we're told that in an act of great courage, it took Amos a lot of courage to go and stand up single-handedly and speak the hard word to the people of Bethel. But I think it took even more courage for Hosea to do what he did. He discovered that Gomer had been reduced to slavery. She had nothing to sell in the way of favors anymore, so she just had to sell her body into slavery. And while she was on the auction block, he saw her and made a momentous decision to participate with everlasting mercy. He went and got 15 shekels of silver, a homer and a half of barley, and he went and laid it at the feet of the auctioneer, and then pointed to that degraded wreck and said, "Her, I want her." Then with a great tenderness, he went and said, "Gomer, let's try it again. Let's pick up and re-give the gift and try to unwind what has gotten all tangled up. I still love you. I do forgive you. Let's try it again." You see, Hosea participated in his own individual agony in the way that he saw God participating with the agony of Israel. And of course, this is the healing process. If people have to become lovable before we love them, if we say, "Okay, clean yourself up, become worthy, and then I will give you the gift of love," nobody ever gets healed that way, because we're already sick unto death. But the revolutionary insight of the Bible is that love is not the reward that God dangles out at the end of the process. God doesn't say, "Become lovable, and then I will love you." But he says, incredibly, "I love you, and I will help you to become lovable." In other words, love becomes the creative force in making us whole, rather than the reward that lies out after we have somehow made ourselves whole. And there's no hope for any kind of sickness unless the gift of mercy and the gift of love is given while the sickness is still on us, If you wait for people to get lovable and then you say, I love them, they never will. If you are willing to love while they are unlovable, that love becomes the dynamic catalyst, hopefully, in creating lovability. You know the little children's story about the Beauty and the Beast? It could only have been written in the context of the biblical revelation. Here was a grotesque-looking figure. No one wanted to be close to him. Everybody was repulsed by him. One day he caught a man stealing in his garden. He was about to devour him. And the man said, please, please save me. And the beast said, only if you will send me your daughter, Beauty, and let her come and marry me, will I let you go. And so the farmer agreed. He went home, got his daughter. She was willing to do this to save her father. She went, as you remember, and lived with the beast. He was so repulsive, and he kept saying, I love you. Will you marry me? And she said, oh, beast, I can't. You're so repulsive. But finally, as he continued and continued to beg her to do this, she agreed. She kissed him. And what happened? The spell was broken. And the beast turned out to be the charming prince, put under an evil spell. And the kiss... The kiss was the thing that had broken it. And you see, the point of the story is that love is the secret that makes people lovable. It is not the reward that you get after you have become lovable. And until we are willing to kiss the beast, until we are willing to get involved lovingly with people who are unlovely, there ain't any way that they're going to get out of what they're under. You see, it was while we were yet sinners that Christ came to die. Not after we had become righteous, but in order that he would give us the power to be righteous. So, what we have in the gospel is a functional process of healing. And what Hosea sensed in God's attitude, what he acted out in his own experience, is the only way that redemption is ever going to come to our sickness. I'm never going to become lovable until somebody loves me in my unloveliness. If you say, you do it, and then I will, you've put me under the impossible sentence. Okay, the third insight that came to Hosea was that God had an incredible mercy. He had hope for Israel, even though they looked like they were not worthy of hope. I'm suggesting that forgiveness is God giving us life again on the same terms that he gave it originally, beyond our deserving. Interesting point here is that we're not told in the book what Gomer did with this offer to start all over again. A romanticist would feel like that the writer really missed a chance to make the telling point. Why didn't he say what Gomer did when she was on the slave block and the homer and half of barley and the shekels were there to set her free? In one sense, you say, how could a person turn down a love like that? After what she had done to Hosea, for him to do that, it's impossible that she could have said no. But the book doesn't tell us, and I'm guessing for a very profound reason, because it leaves that kind of openness to this kind of offer that is really the eternal option. You see, God has power, but he is love. And there is no way that love can coerce another person to love back. By physical coercion, I can make you do many things, but I cannot make you love me. It's a gift. You either give or refuse to give. It is yours and yours alone. And there is no way to force that. There is nothing automatic. Hosea did the best thing that could have been done to give Gomer a chance for joy. But whether or not she took it, that was still in the mystery of her own choice. After all, at one point, she had turned away from her real good to go into a way that didn't produce. And there's no way of knowing what she did with this momentous offer. And there's no way of knowing what you're going to do and what I'm going to do with God's great invitation to come to the party. He wants us to come. It is not the will of the Father that any should perish, but it's not in his hands to make you come into the party.
unless you say yes and unless you're willing. And of course, this is the ultimate theological reason why there is the prospects of hell as well as heaven. But a lot of people say, I can't believe that a loving God would send people to hell. And of course, the truth is, he doesn't. God doesn't send anybody to hell. The only people that go to hell are the people who choose to do it, who are determined that they will not enter the party and live life according to joy. And the dignity that God gives our choices is the basis of hell. God will not force us into the light if we are determined to stay in the darkness. C.S. Lewis says that ultimately, either we'll say to God, Thy will be done, and enter the joy, or God will say to us, Thy will be done, and let us go into the darkness. We're not told what Gomer did. We don't know what we're going to do, because the choice is ours, and there's nothing automatic, and there's nothing coercive. One last word about methodology. The method of Hosea as a prophet is obviously different from that of Amos. His was the methodology of involvement, the methodology of getting close to the person that has a problem, the methodology of saying, I don't give up on you, even though you have blown it, the method of sacrificial love that answers suspicion and mistrust. And I think that though Amos has much to be said for him in terms of his insight, in terms of his courage, I believe there is more hope for changing present situations by the prophetic method of Hosea than the method of Amos. Amos dropped the word on the people and walked out. He said, it's going to happen to you, you better repent. But there were no tears in his eyes. He was not involved. He came from outside and he went back. Hosea, deeply immersed in his own agony and the agony of the nation, participated in the suffering, got close enough to smell it, got close enough to be hurt by it, and in the midst of it refused to give up. He gave hope to Gomer. If she couldn't believe in herself, he said, have faith in my faith. I see something yet in you. There is a future, which of course is what hope is all about. There is a future, even for imperfect creatures. And love and hope and mercy are those that are willing to get close enough to kiss the beast, close enough to where it smells bad, to where it hurts, to where it's repulsive, and dare to say in the midst of what looks like hopelessness, there is a future, there is something yet for you, and I'll lay my life alongside you and intertwined with you to help you become what you haven't yet, but by the grace of God, is still in you to be. And that's redemption. Not guaranteed, but if there's any hope for sickness, it's there. Okay, do you have any questions that you would like to address to me about the book, maybe some things that I haven't had a chance to talk about, or some things that I have said? If you don't have a lot of questions, the suggestion was that we break into groupings of about five and just interact ourselves. First of all, though, do you have any questions that you would like to ask me while the group is still together? Yeah. You mean to marry Gomer in the beginning? I think the basic truth is the same. My own guess is that as Hosea was, you know, was looking back, that he felt that his whole involvement in this experience, you know, had the will of God behind it. That God let him move through this experience. That this insight could be born. I think it's probably makes more sense to see this tragedy unfolding the way I have suggested, rather than her already being a harlot, his marrying her, and, you know, her leaving and then her coming back. But I don't think it fundamentally changes any of the insights of who God is, of what sin is, and what the hope is. Yeah.
You address yourself to the potential prophet in this verse.
Yeah.
And the Amos and in Hosea, we see the spiritual ways,
right,
that they were prophets.
Right.
Like Amos just had an ability and a keenness to observe things, and he spoke out on it. And Hosea had an involvement. He had he like drew a parallel between his life and his nation's life. And there are two individuals, two different ways. Do you think that for the potential prophets here, that we should look at our lives and try to draw a parallel between our experiences and analyze God's prophecies or God's plan for the future through the little things that happen in our
lives? Oh, yes. He's saying, should we have seen how both these men filter, or their word was born out of their unique experience, and should we try to interpret God through our experience? And of course the answer is yes, it's the only base we really have to work with. And I think that you have to be profoundly situational. You know, one thing is appropriate under one set of circumstances, and another thing is appropriate under another set of circumstances. Amos's temperament, his lifestyle, everything made him an isolated, lonely kind of person, whereas Hosea comes through as rather warm, affectionate, person given to close relationships. So you have to trade on the gifts that you've got. And I would say to the prophet, you know, to those of you who sense that you have the gift of understanding, the gift of healing, that you've got to take what you are and where you are, you know, and try to do that which makes for insight and understanding and makes for healing. And how you do it is not as important as you try faithfully to collaborate with God in doing this. There are two kinds of courage, it seems to me. The courage to stand alone, and then the courage to get close and to get involved. And both of them have their own particular risk. It's hard to be the only one staying against the crowd. And it's really hard sometimes to get into all of the processes that go with becoming identified with destructive, sinful people in the hopes of trying to help them. And we just have seen in these 2 days demonstrations of two kinds of courage. And I think that which sustains a man to do what Hosea did, in other words, to get involved with evil, is the profound belief that what goodness can do to evil is greater than what evil can do to goodness. Now, I think basically we don't believe that goodness is more powerful than evil, and therefore we're so afraid that evil will corrupt us that we take the separatist stance. We say, come ye out from among them. And because evil is so powerful, if you get close, you'll get tainted and you'll get sucked in, you know, and therefore everything will be lost. The biblical religion is based on the philosophic premise that goodness is ultimately more powerful than evil. What goodness can do to redeem is greater than what evil can do to corrupt. And therefore the courage that dares to go into the ghetto where there is rampant inhumanity, you know, the courage to get close to sick people, whether it's physical sickness or emotional sickness or what, and to believe that if you go there lovingly, you may suffer terribly. You may even be killed, as Jesus was. But even in the act of killing, there was a dynamic of healing. Goodness went into the center of sickness, and sickness did goodness in, but lo and behold, goodness wound up having a way to heal sickness. So the courage to get involved with imperfect situations grows out of the faith that you carry with you in your love and in your desire to help a more potent force than the infecting germs that are in the situation that do have the power to corrupt.